Welcome to the Quilt Fiction Story Guild podcast, a podcast exclusively for members of the Quilt Fiction Story Guild. I'm Frances O'Rourke Dowell. Thank you for joining us, and as always, thank you for being part of the Quilt Fiction community. Now, on to the story. Family Album, a Friendship Album Story, Florence, November, December, 1934. 1. After the reporter from the Columbus Dispatch leaves, Florence turns to her desk with every intention of getting back to work. The quilting company's catalog is due at the printers by December 1st, which only gives her 2 weeks to pull everything together. She has all the materials in hand, the patterns, articles, ads, and columns, so the job isn't an onerous one, just too easily put off for later. She decides to start with Emmeline's latest article, entitled Quilts Are Judged by the Beauty of Their Quilting. How very Emmeline! Florence supposes she should be grateful that her sister-in-law still contributes anything at all, now that she has her monthly farmer's wife column. Of course, Emmeline, former newspaper woman that she is, never has any problem coming up with copy, no matter what the publication. Moreover, her copy is always clean, typed, no spelling or punctuation errors. Florence rarely has to ask her for corrections. So yes, it's a simple task to edit Emmeline's work. And yet, Florence finds her gaze drifting to the window. The view is of the Ohio River, its surface glinting in the sun, so that the water itself seems a source of light. Florence's mind is still on the interview. The dispatch reporter, a nervous young woman who wrote for the ladies' page and confessed that this would be her first feature article, had been especially interested in Florence's early years, as though they might offer some clues as to how she'd started a successful business during a time when many businesses had gone under. "I grew up on Walnut Street," Florence told the reporter, a Miss Darby. "In fact, I only recently moved out of my childhood home." "What was it like?" Miss Darby asked, her pencil moving swiftly across her notepad. "I suppose what I'm after is a description of your family circumstances." "Well to do," was Florence's blunt reply. Perhaps she should have hemmed and hawed, but what was the point? Florence Grangerfield had been born into wealth and, through luck and some expert financial management by her eldest brother Thomas, she'd held on to it through the worst of the Depression. She doesn't remember how much she understood about her family's fortunes when she was a child. Everything about one's childhood seems inevitable, she thinks, as her eyes follow the progress of a tugboat making its way down the river. Certainly it does when your circumstances are mirrored in the other children you play with and the families with whom your family socializes. Grand houses, household staff, lovely new clothes for every season and all occasions. Florence is sure she never gave any of it a second thought growing up. She knew that poor children existed. She even knew there were poor children in Milton Falls, from trips she made with her mother to the orphanage to deliver winter coats at Christmas time. But they never seemed quite real to her, those children. They were more like characters in a story, not living, breathing children who sometimes went to bed hungry. It wasn't until Thomas married Emmeline that Florence began to understand there were many stops along the way between rich and poor. Emmeline, elegant, glamorous Emmeline, had grown up helping her father in his dry goods store in Emporia, Kansas. She hadn't been poor or wretched by any means, but she had worked, first in her father's store, and then as a reporter for the Daily Kansan, the University of Kansas's student-run newspaper. A newspaper reporter. I started out covering sorority parties and the homecoming balls, Emmeline told Florence one night not long after she'd taken up residence in the Grangerfields' guest suite, where she was staying until the wedding. For propriety's sake, Thomas had taken a room at his gentleman's club on Broad Street. As always, Emmeline was sitting as close as she could to the lamp to better see the quilt block she was sewing, and Florence was stretched out on the settee across from her. "Did you ever cover crimes or anything scandalous?" Florence had asked her soon-to-be sister-in-law. Newly 13, she was interested in whatever her parents tried to shield her from, unseemly romances, murders, and other sordid crimes. Anything that involved people behaving badly. "There wasn't any crime to speak of," Emmeline reported to a disappointed Florence. "And the newspaper didn't publish gossip. But I did do some more serious stories over the years. I wrote an opinion piece about why we should stay out of the war, and I interviewed the chairman of the university's board this spring before graduation." "I'd like to be a newspaper reporter," Florence replied. "Or at the very least, I'd like to do something interesting with my life."
"At some point, every girl has to choose, do something interesting with her life or else marry," Emmeline replied matter-of-factly. "You can't do both. You're lucky that you're rich. If you choose not to marry, you'll still be financially secure."
"I think women should be able to do whatever they want, whether or not they're married," Florence said, feeling like she might cry and desperately resisting the urge. "Did you know that in some Western states, women can vote?"
"So I've heard," Emmeline said. "But they've worked hard for the privilege. In fact, women out west work as hard as men do. They plow and hoe and build log cabins."
"That doesn't sound so very awful," Florence declared, although it didn't sound like the sort of thing she herself wanted to do.
"Well, then, when you come into your money, you can buy 100 acres in Wyoming and have at it."
Florence wasn't sure what Emmeline meant by coming into her money. No one had ever said anything about it to her. She leaned forward and asked, "What will you do when you come into your money?" Emmeline leaned forward and cupped a hand around her mouth as though she were about to tell Florence a highly guarded secret. "My family has no money. And if we had, my brothers would have gobbled it all up before I could get my hands on it. One day I'll take you to Emporia, my dear, and show you where I grew up. It's a far cry from this house, rest assured. No guest suites or sitting rooms, no servants. No mother, for that matter." "No mother?" Again, Florence felt tears threaten. She couldn't imagine her house without her mother in it, filling the rooms with her formidable presence and stern pronouncements. Recently, Florence had become aware of the fact that she didn't like her mother very much, a realization that both unsettled and thrilled her. Still, she wouldn't wish her mother gone. The house needed her. The family needed her. She was its ballast, the true captain of the ship. Florence's father was a darling, but his mind was full of figures and bottom lines and annuities. He didn't care about window dressings or floor coverings or who must be invited for Easter lunch and who should be asked for Christmas dinner. If he had to sit down with a cook to plan a week's menus, he'd be stumped, unable to come up with a single meal. Instruct the gardener? Reprimand the new housemaid? He'd have no idea where to begin. No, the house was her mother's domain, and without her in it, why, Florence and her brothers would be rudderless, lost at sea.
"No mother," Emmeline confirmed. My mother died when I was 3. I grew up half wild, prowling around my father's store in the streets of downtown Emporia. When I was 10 or so, a friend's mother took me in hand, taught me how to quilt, told me about my monthlies and what to do when they arrived. Florence could feel herself blush. She didn't have monthly periods yet and wasn't looking forward to them in the least, though she was looking forward to developing a figure. Then, when I was around your age, my Aunt Margaret moved in with us, Emmeline continued, leaning closer to the lamp to thread her needle. She taught me how to conduct myself like a lady and how to dress, all of it. She's the one who said I should go to college, even though my father thought it was a waste of money to educate a woman. But Aunt Margaret insisted, and so I went. And then you met Thomas, and now you're going to marry him, Florence finished for her, as though she were putting the final touches on a fairy tale. And although she was awfully glad that Emmeline was going to be her sister-in-law, at the same time, she felt a bit sad. How absolutely thrilling it would be were Emmeline a newspaper reporter. A notebook and pad tucked into her handbag, her heels clicking smartly down the street as she walked to the station to check the police blotter. Their talk turned to the wedding, all of the little details that were so fun to think about. Now and again, Florence would look at Emmeline and try to square the young woman in front of her, every part of her absolutely perfect, with the circumstances she'd grown up in. It seemed so different from Florence's experience. Foreign, really. When you come into your money. Somehow, Florence knew she shouldn't ask her mother about this. One really wasn't supposed to talk about money, although she'd never been sure why. The idea that one day she might be a woman of independent means excited Florence's imagination. What should she do when that happened? When would it happen? She would go to college, she decided, and she would be a reporter for the newspaper, just like Emmeline. Maybe things would be different for women by the time Florence became one. Maybe she'd be able to marry and have an interesting life. The times were changing. Florence just knew it. Why, just in the last 2 years, women in North Dakota, New York, Rhode Island, Louisiana, Oklahoma, and Michigan had won the right to vote. Yes, by the time Florence was grown up and had come into her money, she could do whatever she liked. The tugboat honks a warning to an approaching vessel, and Florence finds herself back in her office on the second floor of building number 5, formerly owned by Purefoy Textiles and now owned by the Milton Falls Quilting Company, which is to say, owned by Florence herself. She much prefers owning to renting, in part because as owner, she's secure in the knowledge that what happens to, and in, the building is entirely up to her. No one can sell it out from under her or restrict what she can do within its walls. And if she's being honest with herself, and Florence does her best to be honest with herself, though she's not always successful. Owning the building keeps Arthur Purefoy, her former fiancé, out of her sight lines and more or less out of her spheres of activity. Oh, they run into each other from time to time, and it's fine. Arthur's married now, his wife a young widow with a child, and from all reports they're very happy together. Good. Florence is glad of it. The more removed she is from her courtship with Arthur, the more she believes the two of them would not have been happy in the long run. It took her months to discern why that might be, and she laughed when it finally occurred to her that two people who had such different ideas about how to run a business would never agree on how to run a marriage. In business, Arthur focused on the bottom line, and Florence liked to think about the big picture, which included the bottom line, yes, but other parts of the equation as well. Her employees were people to her. Arthur thought about employees as cogs in a machine. None of this suggested that a happy marriage and family life was in the cards for them. It had been a long, rather slow road, their unraveling. But now Florence is glad of it, and she's glad she owns this building that houses her business. Her businesses, really. So much goes on under one roof. There's the cafe and the fabric shop, a set of classrooms where local quilters improve their skills, and a floor dedicated to making quilts and quilt kits to send out to customers across the country. Every 3 months, Florence creates a new catalog of goods and services, and every day the mail brings in orders. Not infrequently, it also brings personal letters to Florence, thanking her for the catalog itself. "I apologize that in spite of your reasonable prices, I can't afford to buy anything at this time," one woman recently wrote from Iowa. "But I am spending a penny on a stamp to say that I enjoy your quarterly catalog so much. It is like reading a magazine, and I have spent many an evening poring over its pages." Florence had saved the letter, just as she saved all the letters she received. But she slipped this one into her top desk drawer, where it would remind her that her work meant something to people. It wasn't just about making money. One day, Florence would like to publish a quilting magazine filled with patterns and pictures. A magazine that cost little but offered much to its readers. But right now, she has too much to do as it is. With a sigh, she turns back to her desk and the work that awaits her. It only takes a moment before she's fully absorbed in editing articles. All she had to do was begin. Chapter 2. Driving home that afternoon, Florence looked forward to another absorbing project, her new house. And if she's being honest with herself, again, it is her preference to be honest with herself, although sometimes she's anything but. She looks forward to seeing Finn Wyman, the builder who is helping her with renovations, and his young son, Leo. Florence was introduced to Finn earlier in the fall by his uncle when she was first considering buying the house, and he's been working on various projects since September, beginning with the addition of a screened porch off the kitchen. Finn grew up in Milton Falls, but moved away after college. Until 5 years ago, he'd lived in Louisville, where his wife's family was from, but he'd moved home after she died in childbirth, in part so his mother could help him raise Leo. Florence and Finn had an easy friendship from the beginning, and, somewhat to her surprise, over the last 2 months, she and Leo have become thick as thieves. They make an odd trio, the spinster and the widower and his son. Emmeline has commented more than once that Florence is sailing into uncharted territory with this friendship. "I know you're very progressive," she said at a recent Sunday dinner. "Very modern, or avant-garde, or whatever you want to call it. But Milton Falls isn't a progressive place. People will start saying that you and Mr. Wyman are living like man and wife." Florence nearly fell out of her seat. "Man and wife? What are you implying, Emmeline? Spell it out for me." "I'm not implying anything," Emmeline replied with a shrug. "It's just an unusual arrangement, the way the two of you have dinner together most nights. At the kitchen table, no less. Like a fishmonger and his wife." "The three of us have dinner together," Florence pointed out. "There is a child there." Emmeline harrumphed, but she dropped the subject, much to Florence's relief. The entire family was at the table, after all. Fortunately, Mabel, her brother Harry's wife, hadn't overheard. What Mabel wouldn't do with the news that Florence entertained an unmarried man in her home most evenings? "It's not like that," Florence would have to insist over and over, and Mabel would wink and say, "Sure it's not, hun. Sure it's not." Well, it's not, Florence thinks now, a few streets away from home, even though she knows these dinners would qualify as unusual to most people. She and Finn are friends. They share an important common interest, Florence's house. And they get along well. They both have serious sides that they like to hide behind playful banter. It's not surprising that they've fallen into having dinner together, eager as they are to discuss Finn's work. Finn daily expresses his admiration for the house's design, which echoes some of his favorite Frank Lloyd Wright houses, including the Winnett House in Gary, Indiana, where he's traveled to pay homage to. Florence has taken to preparing a dish before she leaves in the morning, a casserole or a pot of soup, something that will keep in the icebox. And Finn contributes to the meal as well, although his contribution almost always consists of his uneaten lunch. Bread and cheese, apples, ham, that sort of thing. Given how involved he is in his work, it's probably no surprise that Finn almost never eats during the day and is almost always famished by the time Florence arrives home in the late afternoon. After building a screened porch onto the back of the house, Finn is now refinishing the attic. He takes a break at 1 to pick up Leo from his little kindergarten and then brings him back to Florence's. If the weather is fine, Leo plays with the other children on the street after a short nap. If it's not, then he sits at Florence's kitchen table and draws and looks at books. Having taught himself to read, Leo's now trying to teach himself how to write. Sometimes Florence's housekeeper, Daisy, sits with him and shows him how to make his letters. For a short-tempered, garrulous old woman, she is surprisingly patient with the motherless boy. Icy rain is spitting against the windshield as Florence pulls the car to a stop in front of her house. Maybe she can convince Finn and Leo to go to Linway's for dinner. This weather calls for more than the sauerkraut and beef casserole she made this morning. Besides, Linway's Tuesday dinner special is meatloaf, mashed potatoes with gravy, and green beans, one of Florence's favorite meals. Gathering her things from the seat beside her, she makes her way up the front walk. Hopefully, the roads won't ice over tonight. Florence's quilting bee meets in the morning, and someone is sure to bring pie. With any luck, it will be Dorothy, who makes the best pie in the Tri-County region. "I'm drawing a picture of a tree," Leo informs her from the kitchen table when Florence comes in and drops her coat and bags onto a chair. Then he holds up his drawing. "Those little balls on the ground are those prickly things that fall from the trees." "Those are called sweet gum balls," Florence says, carrying the tea kettle to the sink to fill it. "They fall out of sweet gum trees. If you pick them when they're green, you can make medicine from them. At least that's what my grandmother told me when I was a child." Leo nods, and Florence knows that he's storing this information away. At nearly 6 years old, the boy likes facts, especially facts about nature. Nature, he is quick to tell anyone who asks, is his favorite thing. Favorite thing doesn't quite get at it, Florence thinks as she lights the stove and puts the kettle on. It's more of a consuming passion. He has over a dozen cigar boxes filled with feathers, rocks, and dried plants to prove it. Recently, he's asked Florence to help him collect more boxes. Leo, it seems, has plans for cultivating a dirt collection and needs more room to house it. If you ask, he will list the kind of dirt he's interested in. Dirt with rocks in it, dirt with sticks in it, and mud and dirt like the kind that the Indians made pots out of. "Is your father still upstairs?" Florence asks him now, reaching for a teacup from the cupboard. "I thought maybe we could all go out to dinner tonight." "He's still up there," Leo informs her, returning to his drawing. "He won't let me go up in the attic because of what happened once when I was a little boy. He says I almost fell through the attic floor in a house he was working on, but I don't remember it. I wish I did. I don't know how you could fall through the floor, though." "Sometimes an attic has a floor that isn't really a floor," Florence says. The kettle's whistle draws her back to the stove. "It's just beams and boards, and maybe not even boards." "And that's what your attic is like?" "Parts of it. That's why Finn is up there, remember? I want the attic to be another room in the house. Maybe it will be the room where I store my quilts. Or maybe I'll put beds there for little boys who come visit me." Leo nods as though agreeing these are fine ideas. Florence drops a tea bag into her cup. She smiles, thinking about how Emmeline would fuss if she were here. Emmeline thinks tea bags are an abomination. Florence thinks they're wonderful time savers and that one day everyone will use them without a thought. Picking up her sewing satchel from the chair where she dropped it a moment before, she goes to the bottom of the stairs and calls up, "Finn, shall we go to Linway's for dinner? They're serving meatloaf."
"With onions?"
The reply sounds as though it's coming from the far end of the attic.
"Of course with onions, and mashed potatoes and gravy."
"Give me 15 minutes,
Finn calls. "We're leaving in 15 minutes, Florence informs Leo from the hallway. "Wash your hands, please." No reply. It would take an act of Congress to make a little boy voluntarily wash his hands. Florence laughs to herself as she walks to her sewing room, satchel in one hand, teacup in the other. You'd think soap and water were pure poison, the way they refuse to go near it. In another house, Florence's sewing room would be the parlor or a sitting room, but this is Florence's house, and Florence has no need for a parlor. What she needs is a well-lit place to make quilts, and here it is, a large, airy room with windows on two sides. Her machine, a Singer 101, sits in its cabinet by the south window, a sleek black creature that purrs as Florence sews. She has spent entire evenings here, lost in thought as she guides fabric under the machine's needle. She leaves an ironing board set up, her new Westinghouse iron resting on top of it, waiting to be plugged in and put to work. The old farmhouse table takes up the middle of the room. It's where Florence composes her quilts, cutting out pieces using cardboard templates and scissors. Emmeline has made it clear that this table has no business anywhere near Florence's house, but Florence disagrees. It is a beautiful, useful object. A bit rustic, perhaps, but as soon as she saw it at an auction outside of Worcester, she knew it was the table for her. The Wednesday Bee will gather at 9 o'clock at Bess's house, and Florence wants to pack her things so that she's not rushing around on her way out the door in the morning. She puts her satchel on the table and peeks inside. Now that she has recommitted herself to quilting, she always has at least two quilts in the works, one she's making by machine and the other by hand. While Florence loves machine piecing and pooh-poohs the idea that machine-sewn quilts are somehow lesser than hand-sewn, the fact is she can't carry her machine wherever she goes. When she has a spare moment or two during the day, or needs to think a matter through, she takes out her hand piecing and starts to stitch. As a matter of fact, she worked on a block today as she dictated letters to her secretary, Nettie.
Almost done, Florence thinks as she carefully extracts the block from her bag. It's a Shaker House block, red and white, from a pattern that Emmeline designed for her September Farmer's Wife column. Florence plans on making 16 of the 12-inch blocks, which will produce a quilt perfect for covering up as she reads by the fire on winter evenings. A house quilt for her new house. As soon as Florence thought of the idea, she knew it was exactly right. When she gets back from dinner tonight, she'll cut out more block pieces just to make sure she has enough for 2 hours of sewing. Oh, she's so glad she's made a commitment to attending the Bee on a regular basis these days. When they first began meeting, in January of last year, Florence was a faithful member, but once her new business got up and running, Wednesdays almost always found her doing anything but sewing. These days, the Milton Falls Quilting Company is running smoothly enough that she can make room in her schedule for time to sit and sew with her friends. It's almost like going to church in the middle of the week, she's thought more than once, the way it restores and renews her spirit. Finn appears in the doorway.
"I'm going to wash up and then I'll be ready to go," he announces. "I may have to order 2 plates of meatloaf tonight. I'm famished."
"Forgot to eat lunch again, did you?" Florence asks, even though she already knows the answer. Finn grins.
"I always mean to, but once I start working, I never want to stop. The fact is, I don't even notice the time pass. Hours can go by and it feels like minutes."
Florence knows this feeling. In fact, it is her favorite feeling in the world. Nature may be Leo's favorite thing, but for Florence, it's getting lost in the act of making a quilt. She thinks it's what heaven must be like. You'll quilt for 10,000 years, and it will feel as though only a few minutes have passed.
Thanks for joining us on the Quilt Fiction Story Guild podcast, a production of Milton Falls Media, Incorporated. All rights reserved. Until next time, this is Frances O'Rourke Dow. Thank you for joining us.